From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the new Disney Pixar animated movie Up with the director and co-writer Pete Docter. Up is the story of a 78-year-old man and an 8-year-old boy who pilot a house held aloft by balloons to a remote part of South America. The movie has a great exotic giant bird, talking dogs, a surprising villain, and plenty of laughs, but it's also about an old man who can't let go of the past and a boy insecure about his future. Earlier this month, Up became the first animated movie to open the Cannes Film Festival. Our critic-at-large, John Powers, was at the festival. He'll tell us about the award winners. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new Pixar Disney animated movie Up opens Friday. Earlier this month, Up became the first animated film to open the Cannes Film Festival. My guest is the director and co-writer of Up, Pete Docter. He also directed Monsters, Inc. Up is about an unexpected relationship between an old man and a boy. Carl is a 78-year-old whose beloved wife has died. Carl and his wife dreamed of being adventurers, but they were really homebodies. He made his living selling balloons. Now his neighborhood is getting rebuilt around him, and the developers want him to move to assisted living so they can tear down his house and put up a high-rise. Carl refuses. His way out of the problem is to tie thousands of balloons to his house so he can fly the house to South America, where he once dreamed of making an expedition with his wife. But as he's getting ready, a chubby 8-year-old named Russell knocks on the door. Russell is wearing his Wilderness Explorer uniform that has a sash covered with badges.
Photo print. SD card.
Good afternoon. My name is Russell, and I am a Wilderness Explorer in Tribe 54, Sweat Lodge 12. Are you in need of any assistance today, sir?
No.
I could help you cross the street.
No.
I could help you cross your yard.
No.
I could help you cross your porch.
No.
Well, I gotta help you cross something.
No, I'm doing fine.
After Carl slams the door, he cuts loose the hot air balloons and starts piloting his house to South America, not realizing that Russell is still on the porch. So Russell and Carl become companions on this fantastic adventure. Pete Docter, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I love the image that a lot of our listeners might have seen in one of the ads of this old man walking through this exotic jungle landscape, you know, Paradise Falls, mm-hmm. with his house attached to a string that he's carrying as if the house were a balloon, but the house is being held aloft by all these balloons. And it's a beautiful image because it's him trying to take his past with him. It's the home he lived in with his wife for so many years, and she's passed away. So he's carrying the past on his back, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, it becomes too heavy. It becomes a burden, and he has to figure out if he should let go or not. And I thought, like, I don't know how that image came to you, or if you originally meant it to be like a metaphor, but it's such a beautiful image about carrying the past and how it can sometimes become too heavy, too much.
Yeah, it kind of evolved. I mean, as all things do, you know, we started with something about balloons themselves are very poetic and evocative to me, and more than just helium and vinyl or whatever they're made out of, you know. They become this almost metaphor for life in a way. I remember as a kid having a balloon and accidentally letting the string go and watching it just float off and into the sky until it disappeared. And there's something about that even that feels very much like what life is, you know, that you, it's fleeting and it's temporal. And so something about balloons were really appealing. And also the idea of escape and floating away. And so as we developed the whole story, it became a lot about trying to preserve the past. You know, this guy, the whole world has changed. Everything around him is different now. The only thing he has this feeling of connection with his wife is his house. So he can't just leave that behind. He has to take it with him.
It reminded me a little of Fitzcarraldo. Did you ever see Fitzcarraldo?
Yeah.
It's a Werner Herzog film,
sure.
In which this explorer who wants to build an opera house in the South American jungle, in order to get to where he's going, he has to carry his steamship over a mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And the burden of that reminded me at some point of the house being dragged, dragged through
yeah.
the air across.
Absolutely.
Did you see the movie? Did you think about that?
We watched it along the way, yeah, and it was very similar in the sort of preposterous nature of this. You know,
yes, right, and surreal. And,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Sounds like a laugh riot, doesn't it?
Well, it's really funny, and I'll tell you, you had me from the start because very early in the film, the young version of the older man, because it starts earlier in time, like in the 30s and
Right.
The Prohibition era. So he's watching like one of those old newsreel kind of things about this adventurer who goes to Paradise Falls, a forgotten land. And you see like the scientists and the explorers with a protractor.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's so funny, a protractor.
Well, it was high tech back then.
It's high tech, yeah. So you had me right at the start.
Well, good.
Did you watch a lot of those newsreels and shorts before making your movie?
Absolutely, yeah. It was a lot of fun to not only try to pick up on the film grain and stuff. You know, we noticed that when they would say be in the jungle, they'd have to develop the film themselves so it would have less contrast and maybe a little washed out. And then versus the film they shot in New York, that would have really striking blacks and whites. And so we tried to mimic all that in the film, as well as even the way we recorded the music, you know, working with Michael Giacchino. We identified, I want heroic, I want drama, suspense, I want this. And so we just did all those, like, library music, and then we did really bad music edits between them. So it's going along, dun, 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 you know, so it'll have these awkward transitions, just like, you know, the real real newsreels.
Just in talking about the old man, one more thing about him, like, the way he sits down in a chair, it's like he slowly lowers himself. And when he gets within plopping distance, he just like lets go and plops into it. And I've seen so many older people have to sit that way. Like, you really got it.
That's great. You noticed that. The other thing we did is he pulls his pants up, like he grabs right above the knee and kind of hikes up his pants. I have no idea why older people do that, but you notice that a lot, you know, just to, I guess, to so that it doesn't get hooked on your heel or something. Anyway, we did look at a lot of folks, our grandparents, and we went to an old folks' home. We kind of came in under the auspices of being a band, because I play the bass and a couple of guys who played the ukulele. And so we were playing for these guys and secretly kind of taking little notes for ourselves.
Oh, that's really funny. What do you play? What kind of music?
It was sort of like a Tin Pan Alley type stuff.
Oh, that would be perfect, because it's the kind of music a lot of people, like, in assisted living facilities would have grown up with.
Yeah, they said, oh, you were the greatest band we've had in here for a long time. So it was great. It was a fun time.
My guest is Pete Docter, and he directed and co-wrote the new Pixar Disney animated film Up. You created a great creature for the movie, this exotic 13-foot bird named Kevin.
Right.
Well, that's because Russell names it Kevin.
Yeah, exactly.
But I want you to describe the bird that you created.
Well, Kevin is a 13-foot-tall, flightless bird, very iridescent plumage, sort of based on a crane that I saw at a zoo. The attraction for me was that these birds, when you see them at the zoo, they almost have no expression. You can't see what they're thinking. They give you no kind of advance warning of are they happy or sad, or at least to me. I'm sure bird experts can tell. But they're really unpredictable and quirky and funny. And I just, the animator in me was like, I want to animate that. So that's kind of where Kevin came from, was just the joy of seeing these quirky behaviors.
So, but you gave Kevin emotion, the kind of emotion you couldn't read in the real bird,
right,
that you based him on. So what kind of methods did you find for giving your bird emotion?
Well, the cool thing was we did the same thing that I described, where there is no facial expressions. And the Muppets do this wonderfully, where, you know, you have like Fozzie, who has no facial, other than he can open and close his mouth. The rest of it's just movement. And so the bird has a great deal of expression and a range of attitudes, but it's all through movement. It's almost like Charlie Chaplin or Buster Keaton, which, of course, all animators study, and those are our roots. So, you know, just through the movement, the posing, the speed at which they move, we were able to get all this attitude.
So did you go to South America?
We did. Yeah, there was a group of 10 of us. And this is the great thing about working at Pixar. You know, Toy Story, we got to go to the toy store with the company credit card. And on this one, since we set it in South America, a group of 10 of us flew down to South America to these amazing tabletop mountains. And we hiked up there. It took us 3 days just to get there by plane, helicopter, jeep. And then we hiked up. We slept up there. We drew a lot. We took tons of pictures, of course. And there are fantastic, weird plants found nowhere else in the world, these weird rock shapes that are just windswept, strange, bizarre shapes. Some of them look like people or animals. And a lot of ideas from the film came from that trip.
So what's in your sketchbook that you took back from there?
Well, there's a lot of pictures of myself. I'm usually drawn to drawing people. Like, I love to go to the airports and just put on, like, dark glasses so nobody can tell I'm staring at them and just draw people. It's a lot of fun, and it's just endless hours of entertainment just watching the way people do simple things, even, like, eat a meal or, you know, wipe their kid's face or whatever, just great behavior stuff. But up there, of course, and even there, I ended up drawing a lot of my coworkers. But the reason we were there was to draw the landscape, and I struggled as best I could to capture that.
And we talked a little bit about the bird that you created for Up. There's a bunch of dogs. There's a pack of really, like, mean dogs, and then there's a really pleasant and companionable dog named Doug.
Right.
First of all, I think it's kind of interesting that, you know, they go to this, like, exotic place. And usually in adventure films, especially in the old ones, before people were very kind of politically aware of what they were doing, this, you know, adventurers would go to an exotic land in Africa, and then the natives would want to cook them in a big pot. And it was just, like, the most kind of insulting image of indigenous people that you could ask for. And you made it possible to not deal with that at all by having the villains, with the exception of one person, be dogs.
Right.
So you didn't, and there's a good guy dog too, so you didn't have to worry about, you know, offending anybody. Or
yeah, and of course that is one of the staples of adventure film, so I won't pretend we didn't at least discuss that. You know, we had some ideas about that. But yeah, it just seemed, again, keeping on the sort of isolation thing. And there is something, for those of us who have dogs as pets, I mean, I'm sure most people have the same experience as I do, is we make up dialogue for the dog. So the dog is sitting next to the dinner table, and we make up things that she's talking about, which most of the time is, are you going to eat that? Because I could help you with that. If you need help, I am happy to. So that's kind of where the talking dogs came from. And Bob Peterson, who did most of the dialogue and actually did the voice of Doug, just has this great mind for thinking like a dog.
And explain how it is that Doug can speak, the dog.
Yeah, the invention we came up with was this collar, which allows the dog's thoughts to be translated. So the dog in behavior is acting just like a normal dog, panting or doing whatever, but you're hearing the dialogue from the dog's brain. So that allowed us to focus on things that a real dog would focus on, which is, you know, food and sniffing at squirrel, you know, things like that. So,
and the collar has adjustments so you could change the language.
Absolutely. Very important.
Let's hear a clip of Doug, the dog, and listen to his voice. And the two main characters are in this, too. And Bob Peterson, one of the writers, is doing the voice of Doug.
We have your dog.
Whoa.
Wonder who he belongs to.
Sit, boy. Hey, look, he's trained. Shake. Uh-huh. Speak.
Hi there.
Did that dog just say hi there?
Oh, yes.
Bruh!
My name is Doug. I have just met you, and I love you. My master made me this collar. He is a good and smart master, and he made me this collar so that I may talk.
Squirrel!
My master is good and smart.
It's not possible.
Oh, it is, because my master is smart.
Cool. What do these do, boy?
Hey, would you cut that cradle contigo? I use that collar. Wakashiwa Hanashima to talk with. I would be happy if you stop.
So that's a clip from the new Pixar Disney animated movie Up, and my guest, Pete Docter, co-wrote and directed the film. Pete, what are some of your favorite talking animated animals?
Huh. Well, I mean, of course, the Bugs Bunny, and there's a dog named Charlie Dog that I always think of. It was a Chuck Jones character. Let's see. Other favorite characters. Well, I mean, I tend to drift over to the Warner Brothers characters as my favorite just characters, because they're so rich and funny. As movies, I tend to drift over to the Disney films, you know, as stories and things. Dumbo is one of my favorites. It's just such a simplicity, a wonderful simplicity to it. And as a kid, you know, I saw certain things about it, all the fun and, you know, pink elephants on parade and flying with the crows and things. And now looking back on it, it's got this added dimension to it as a parent that, you know, when you have baby mind, the scene with the trunks, and they can't even see each other. They can just kind of hold trunks. I've yet to watch that without crying, you know. And Cinderella is great, too. It's got a great sense of pacing. I hadn't seen it for a while, and watched it again a couple of years ago, and it's just got this great rhythm where you allow for moments. We tried to do this in this film as well. In a way, this film was trying to harken back to some of those films where you set up a situation, and instead of having to go, what happens next? What happens next? Move it along, move it along. You can allow the characters to just behave and react. And to me, some of the greatest animation, Miyazaki does this, Hayao Miyazaki in his films, these just little observations. And that's all they are. They don't further the plot, but they are beautiful little glimpses into real life, somehow captured and distilled and made even more real through animation. And that's what we're trying to do in this film as well.
My guest is Pete Docter. He directed and co-wrote the new Pixar-Disney animated film Up. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Pete Docter, and he directed and co-wrote the new Pixar-Disney animated movie, Up. Now, I read that for the voice of Russell, the boy in the movie, that you cast the brother of a kid who actually came to audition.
Yeah.
The kid that you cast didn't come to audition. He was the brother of the kid who came to audition. How did that happen?
Well, yeah, and hopefully that hasn't caused a rift between them.
What I keep wondering. Like, what's it like to be the actual acting brother and not get the part?
I know. Well, yeah. His brother, Jordan's brother, Hunter, still does quite a bit of acting on his own. So I think he
survived.
Happy.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, we were looking for somebody. And, you know, this is always a treacherous area to walk into as you're approaching something like a kid. Because it's so easy to be cloying and sappy and or just like bad acting, you know. And we wanted this to be authentic and real sounding. And when we heard this kid, he came in and, like you say, he wasn't even planning to audition. His brother stepped up and they said, thank you, great. Well, how about you? Jordan, why don't you come over here? And he just, I think he talked about judo or something, you know. And his voice just made me laugh. He had this really wonderful, sweet, innocent voice. And it's a little bit like you hear the stories of the voice of Thumper from Bambi. You know, they were reading kids, and the director said, oh, get him out of here. He can't act. And the animator said, no, no, keep him, you know, because there's something really charming and quirky and kind of undefinably odd. And that's exactly what we got with Jordan. He just has this really great appeal to his stuff. And then, of course, we did have to work a little bit to get some of the acting. He covers a big range of emotions. And having never done it before, you know, we basically did a lot of tricks where, like, you know, we tried to get him to laugh and it was just not really working. So I picked him up by the ankle, held him upside down, and tickled him as he said the line. So as he's being tickled by the bird, that's what that is. So, yeah, it's a tricky gig, especially here. You know, you're in a room that has, and we record the dialogue first, of course, so there's no animation to react to. You're just in a gray room with a bunch of words on a page, and 9 times out of 10, no other actors even. We try to read opposite. Bob Peterson and myself would usually read opposite, but it largely has to kind of come to life in their own heads, the actors.
So you cast Ed Asner as the older man. So did you have an idea of what he would look like before you cast Ed Asner, or which came first in your mind?
Well, we had the story, and we even designed the character. He was finished. We had him all. I don't think he was quite finished being built in the computer, but the design was there. And what we did, and we have done this on all the films, is we grab little snippets of dialogue from other movies. And so while we're looking at these designs, we just listen. And some people just fit perfectly, and Ed was one of those guys.
Oh, I see. You take their dialogue from other films and juxtapose it with the image that you have and see if it fits.
Exactly.
So what did you do with him, like Mary Tyler Moore Show stuff?
Yeah, and then we got some of his more recent films, you know, because it's some time has passed since Mary Tyler Moore.
A lot.
But yeah, he just had this real sort of still the gruffness and the, you know, angularity to his voice with an underlying sense that, oh, this guy really does care, you know. Which is exactly what we needed for the film.
Now, your daughter does the voice of the young girl who becomes Ed Asner's wife in the movie, who becomes the man's wife in the movie. How did your daughter... What a shock that you would find your daughter, but why did you give her the part?
Well, the way we work at Pixar is we write the script, but then we quickly move on into story reel, which is basically like a comic book version of the film. And then we do our own dialogue and music and sound effects, all in an effort to be able to basically sit in the theater and watch the movie before we shoot it, essentially. And that way, you know, once you get into animation, it's horribly time-consuming. It's like... animators do about 4 seconds a week, you know, and that's not even including all the shaders and the lighting and the modeling and all that. So we want to whittle out all the stuff that we have any questions about first. And so what we did when we got to that part, yeah, the beginning of the film takes place with in the 30s as they're kids. And we knew that if one of us tried to do the voice of a kid, people would be so distracted by that that you wouldn't pay attention to the scene. So we just got my daughter to come in, and we thought, well, this will work until we find a professional actor. But enough people really loved it. In fact, that was the first thing Ed Asner said when we showed him. He said, "Who does the voice of that kid? She steals the show." So that was pretty cool.
So did you have her redo it or just use the tracks that she did?
No, we just used the tracks. Yeah, she was about 7 and a half at the time. And we worked with her much like we worked with Jordan, or, you know, kind of tricking her into things or doing the copy game where we'd say the line and she'd parrot it back. And we found with both kids that, you know, physicality is a big thing. And so standing stiffly in front of a microphone is not really the best way to get a great performance. With Jordan, a lot of times I would say, okay, now you've memorized the line. Before you say this next take, run back around that chair, run around 3 times, jump up and down, run back to the microphone, then say the line, ready, go. And so you'd just get them all worked. How many times do I need? Oh, okay. And then he'd be much more animated and lively having run around the room. So that was fun.
Yeah, that's
it was pretty exhausting
cool.
For me, too, by the end of the day.
Pete Docter will be back in the second half of the show. He directed and co-wrote the new animated movie Up. It opens Friday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Progressive Insurance, sponsor of the Progressive Automotive X Prize, a race to develop cars that exceed 100 miles per gallon. Now, that's progressive. From Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary. On the web at healthreform.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Pete Docter says he's most proud of the opening sequence in his new animated movie Up. Coming up, we talk with him about it. Up was the opening film at the Cannes Film Festival. Our critic at large, John Powers, just returned from Cannes. He'll tell us about the award winners. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Pete Docter, the director and co-writer of the new Disney-Pixar animated movie Up. It opens Friday. Docter also directed the Pixar movie Monsters, Inc. and was one of the writers of WALL-E and Toy Story. Now, Up is in 3D, And I'll confess, I had known that, but when I went to the advanced screening of it before interviewing you, I'd kind of forgotten that it was in 3D, and I didn't see it in 3D.
Mm-hmm.
So what did I miss? I really love the film. It obviously doesn't have to be in 3D to enjoy it, but what did I miss?
Well, I mean, we tried to use 3D as just another element to tell the story. So, for example, when Carl is alone in his house, we really tried to squash space to make him feel claustrophobic and locked in. And then by contrast, as he floats his house off, we really tried to push the depth and make him seem free. So it's, to us, kind of another tool like lighting, like color, cinematography. It's just another way of furthering the emotion that we're trying to communicate to the audience.
So did you work on the 3D part of it?
I worked with, there was a separate group that we set up. So initially, when we started the project, we had no thought of doing 3D. We were just doing focused on story and characters. And John Lasseter came to us, I think it was about a year and a half, 2 years in, and said, hey, we'd really love to do this in 3D. So we set up a group, much like, you know, we have the art department, we have the animation department, and now we have the 3D department. And they followed along sequence by sequence and would use 3D in the way I described, really trying to further the story. But I'll confess, it was not really in the forefront of my mind. The things I was most focused on were just story and character. We tried to use it a little more like a window that you look into, as opposed to, I don't know about you, whenever I see 3D movies and stuff is going booga 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 in your face, I'm suddenly aware, oh, that's, I'm sitting in a theater wearing dopey glasses, you know. So we tried to use it much more subtly and a little more like, you know, my father had a bunch of stereophonic test records when I was growing up, and you'd have, you know, bongos on the left channel and trombones on the right channel. And now it's, you know, much more integrated and subtle. And that's kind of the way we were trying to approach the 3D on this film as well.
The movie is dedicated in part to one of the Disney animators from the early days. Tell us about him.
Yeah, Joe Grant was a guy, and this was really the great pleasure of having worked on Toy Story and having that be as successful as it was. Suddenly, I got to meet all these old heroes of mine that had made all the Disney films, you know, Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnson. And Joe Grant was basically second only to Walt in development, the story development team back in the 40s, 30s and 40s. He was head of story on Dumbo and designed the Wicked Queen in Snow White. So really, you know, amazing artist. And he was still working in his 90s. That's when I got to know him. And he was just one of these guys who was always looking for new ways of expressing himself, new techniques, new pencils or pens. And one thing he talked about a lot in when I would pitch him things was, what are you giving the audience to take home? And at first I was like, well, what does that mean, taking the audience to take home? What he was talking about was, what are you putting up on the screen that's emotionally relatable, that they will identify with and think about not only when the movie's done, but the next day or the next week or the next year? And, you know, that's what we always try to do in our films, is definitely there in those great Disney films.
When you started as an animator, were you given, like, the bottom of the pyramid kind of jobs to do? And what are those jobs like?
Well, yeah, when I started, this is back in the 80s, I was painting the backs of cells. Of course, cells are these celluloid sheets of plastic. They're actually made out of acetate, but they don't use them at all anymore. It's all computers. So the animator would draw something on paper. It would then be inked or Xeroxed onto the cell, and then my job was to paint the backs the right color, you know, so that they would read against the background and not just, you couldn't see through them. So that's kind of like the bottom tier. And then I worked my way up doing in-betweens, and this was all...
What's an in-between?
In-between, so an animator does the key poses. He'll do extremes, you know, like a character reaching out for a glass of water and then another one of him drinking. And the in-betweener has to do all the drawings that go between those two. You know, it could be 12, 20, what, 3, whatever, in-betweens. And then that was all hand-drawn, and that's kind of what I was picturing that I would end up doing. And then I got a call towards my last year of school from John Lasseter. And working at Pixar was great because they paired these amazing people who knew brilliant scientists with artists, each one ignorant in the other's work, and yet both working towards the same common goal and produce some pretty groundbreaking stuff.
Earlier in the film, you have to establish since the movie is in part about an older person's relationship to his past, you have to establish what his past was mm-hmm. before getting into the heart of the story.
Right.
And you, in just like a few minutes, establish this like beautiful relationship with his wife. You know, they meet as children. They both share this love of adventure. And it's a really kind of sweet but also sad relationship. And when she dies, you're just so sad. And it's so much to squeeze into, what, 3 or 4 minutes. Can you describe a little what went into reducing a whole backstory and a marriage and a life into this little sequence?
Yeah, that was probably the sequence I'm most proud of. That scene is just... and we started much like you would writing, say, a term paper where you go way long. You just put in all this. We had a bunch of scenes that were little with dialogue and just little short little bursts of life. And then we assembled all that together and we realized, oh, this is way too long. And so Bob Peterson had written this great first draft of it. Ronnie Del Carmen, who's our head of story, started drawing it. And he has this beautiful way of just kind of kissing the paper with his pencil, and they wonderfully expressive and very sort of poetic, lyrical drawings. And we got to that point, and we kept cutting and cutting, and we took out dialogue, we took out sound effects even. And sort of inspired a little bit by my parents growing up took a lot of Super 8 films of us as kids. And looking at them now, they're just these almost more emotional experiences to watch because the sound isn't there. You know, all you have is the flicker of the projector. And I think you as an audience member are sort of drawn into that and participate a little bit more.
Tell me more about the impact of those Super 8 movies that your parents made of the family when you were young.
Yeah, I mean, they're just films of us standing in a hole my dad dug to plant a tree, or my mom walking around pregnant with my sister. And, you know, these are like I have probably fleeting glimpses in my own life, memories of that. But watching them on screen, they're kind of... I don't know. And there may be something about the fact that they're projected as well, that they're just kind of shadows of a past that... And as you watch it, it's like I say, I think because there's no sound, you're missing something. It becomes slightly more abstract and yet almost more real. In the same way, we have tapes, audio tapes of my sisters and I talking as well. And that's almost more emotional than videotape. When you get them both together somehow, it's almost... You can sit back and watch it like TV. It's kind of everything's fed to you, whereas by taking one of those elements away, you have to be more actively participating in the experience.
Pete Docter, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Pete Docter directed and co-wrote the new Pixar-Disney animated movie Up. It opens Friday. Earlier this month, Up became the first animated film to have the prestigious position of opening the Cannes Film Festival. Our critic at large, John Powers, just returned from Cannes. He'll tell us about the award winners after a break. This is Fresh Air. The 62nd Cannes Film Festival wrapped up on Sunday. Cannes is the most important festival showcase for new films from around the world. The festival's held in the south of France. Our critic at large, John Powers, who is also film critic for Vogue, just got home from Cannes, and he's going to tell us about some of the award-winning films he saw there, films that we'll get the chance to see in the U.S. within the next few months. Hi, John. Tell us what made this year's Cannes Film Festival different from all the others you've been to.
Yes, well, Cannes differs from year to year in attitude and tone. You know, a few years ago during, you know, at the beginning of the Iraq War, you could actually feel the hostility to Americans because Europeans in particular didn't like the war. What was striking this year was what I would call the existence of austerity Cannes. And you know, that may sound like a contradiction in terms, because during the festival, Cannes actually is home to the greatest concentration of wealth in the world, you know, because all those people out in yachts are worth billions of dollars. But what was striking this year was, first of all, from an American point of view, how many fewer Americans were there. And that ranged from everything from movie stars — there were just far fewer big stars this year — to far fewer American journalists. You know, when I used to come, you were just packed with Americans fighting against one another for the stories. Whereas this year, you know, lots of papers didn't send critics. You know, lots of magazines that used to send teams are now sending one person. And although the festival was still crowded, it wasn't insanely crowded this year.
Are European newspapers going through the same kind of cutbacks that American newspapers are? Are European newspapers folding at the rate American newspapers are?
Well, European newspapers are suffering the way American newspapers are, but not to the same extent. And what you don't have in Europe in the same way is, you know, the steady drumbeat of papers actually going under. At the same time, I think film criticism is taken more seriously in Europe than it is in the U.S. Whereas here, I think at many papers, the film critic is now thought to be a luxury. And so all across the country, newspapers and magazines have just gotten rid of the film critics. Whereas in France, you know, that I think you'd probably get rid of almost anything before you'd get rid of the film critic for your paper.
So let's talk about some of the winners at the Cannes Film Festival. The film that won the festival's top prize is The White Ribbon. Tell us about the film. What did you think of it?
Well, it's a film by the Austrian director Michael Haneke, who is sort of known in America. He made the movie The Piano Teacher and a film called Cachet, but is a huge directorial star in Europe. And he's an Austrian director who's a bit of a moralist. His films are a bit like castor oil, because he's always trying to teach you a lesson. And I've liked some of his films and haven't liked some of the others. I like this one. It's set in a German village before World War I. And in this German village, some strange and unpleasant things are happening. Someone sets up a wire and trips a horse as it goes by. A little boy is beaten up. And the whole question is, why is this happening? Who's doing this? That's the thriller aspect of the story. Over the course of the next 2 hours and 20 minutes, what you gradually get is a picture of the culture of this seemingly idyllic village, where you realize that all the authority figures, in particular the fathers, are imposing a particular idea of what a good child is like, and that this idea is finally going to be the roots of what gives you fascism, so that there is this sense that all children should be innocent and good, and the parents are particularly sadistic and brutal, both psychologically and physically, in enforcing this idea. So if a young boy is, if you fear that your son is going to be masturbating, you literally tie him to the bed. If your daughter's behaving badly, you make her wear a white ribbon all the time, which is where the film gets its title, reminding her that you're supposed to be innocent and pure. And so gradually what you get in this investigation of this village is a view of Germany just before World War I, creating the generation that will ultimately lead to the creation of Nazi Germany.
Now, the head of the jury which selected this film was the actress Isabelle Huppert, who starred in one of Haneke's earlier films, The Piano Teacher. So did she have to recuse herself?
Oh, no, there's no such thing as recusing in film festivals. I think, you know, that Wall Street people would be thrilled to have the rules of insider trading that film festivals have. Yes. You know, so that going into the final weekend, because when people are discussing what's going to win, all the people that can become like Kremlinologists or Vatican followers trying to figure out what's really going on. And most people who knew what was going on thought that the Haneke film, The White Ribbon, would probably win.
Okay, second prize at Cannes Film Festival went to a French film called A Prophet. It's a prison movie. Tell us about this one.
Yes, the second prize winner, one of the Grand Prix, was called A Prophet by Jacques Audiard. And it was probably my favorite film in the festival. And it was all the more surprising to me because I kind of dreaded seeing it. The little blurb but when you went in said it's about a young French Arab man who's sent to prison. And I thought, that doesn't sound very good. I hate prison movies. But what happens in this one, which runs 2.5 hours, is that this young French Arab guy starts off a pure victim and over the course of the next 2.5 hours gradually learns the ropes of the prison, how to negotiate the power struggle between the local Corsican gangsters and the Islamists. And over the course of 2.5 hours, transforms himself into some sort of crime boss. So that he starts off this loser guy who's a teenager and winds up a bit maybe like Michael Corleone. In fact, the final images of the film have a real hint of The Godfather about them. And what's great about the film is not only that the lead actor is really terrific, his name is Tahir Rahim, he's a new discovery, but that you watch step by step how the prison works, how power is arranged, how you make your way in this world, and you watch the guy grow bit by bit from being this bit of a loser to being this extremely powerful guy. It's a really, really terrific film, incredibly gripping.
What was the most controversial film at Cannes?
The film that people fought to get in to see and then couldn't wait to boo in many cases was a film called Antichrist by the Danish director Lars von Trier. Now, people here will know him for Breaking the Waves and Dogville, among other films. And he's a provocateur. This film starts off, it looks like a family film in a way, or a domestic psychological drama. Willem Dafoe and Charlotte Gainsbourg play a couple whose child dies. And the Gainsbourg character goes into a great period of grief. And to help cure her grief, Dafoe takes her to their cottage in the woods in the American Northwest. So far, so good. But then what happens about halfway through is the film goes berserk. And Dafoe starts meeting foxes that actually talk to him. You get rains of the house is pounded by falling acorns. And the Gainsbourg character eventually gets crazier and crazier until you're entering the world where the suggestion is that Gainsbourg is herself as an expression of femininity, the Antichrist.
Very nice.
Yes. Oh, very
woman
nice.
Is yeah, well, Antichrist.
The woman is Antichrist. You know, and it's the kind of film who plays on male paranoia. So she wants to make love all the time, and then when you refuse, she thinks you're going to leave her. So she actually drills a hole in your leg, and actually and puts a spike through it to keep you there. It's an incredibly entertaining, very crazy movie. Filled with jokes and violent imagery. And the Cannes audience, I think, was expecting something much more serious from von Trier, who's many of whose films are, you know, weighty in a spiritual or psychological way or making some important point. Whereas this one seemed like a joke in lots of ways. So it was hugely booed at Cannes. One of those great Cannes experiences is having to literally fight your way into a screening because everybody's dying to see it. And then at the end of the film, listening to huge parts of the crowd boo the film.
So I'm not sure if you liked it or not. I can't tell.
Yes. I didn't like it, but I really enjoyed watching it because von Trier is one of those art film directors who never will ever bore you. It's such a strange and crazy movie filled with stuff I can't describe on the radio that you sit there rapt. And what's funny to me is that every year there's a film or two like this that's clearly designed to get attention and shake people up, to be deliberately provocative. And what's startling to me is how every year a huge number of critics fall for it and then become outraged and get all moralistic when it was clear that the whole point of the movie was to wind people up and to be a bit of a lark or a provocation. You know, it's not unimportant that this film was going to open in France, I think, next week in 130 theaters. So to have the entire world being outraged and talking about this movie at the Cannes Film Festival is a great piece of marketing. And in lots of ways, that's what this film is. There's no comparable American version of this, of some film that's just there to get you. You know, probably the closest thing, if you can imagine this, would be something like Snakes on a Plane, where the concept seems so vivid people want to see it. In this case, to have an art film called Antichrist with a tremendous trailer that seems very exciting, and you think, oh, here's this art film director making a horror movie. You know, that's such a juicy package that people just couldn't wait to see it. And then, of course, having seen it, most of them were outraged.
My guest is our critic at large, John Powers. We'll talk more about the Cannes Film Festival after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is our critic at large, John Powers. He just returned from the Cannes Film Festival. When we left off, we were talking about controversial films at this year's festival. Now, I understand there's one film so controversial and so maybe distasteful. At the Cannes Film Festival, you didn't even go.
I didn't even go. It's a Filipino film called Kinete by a talented director named Briante Mendoza. And what it's about is basically a young guy gets, you know, who's sort of a young police cadet, gets told to go along with some friends on this job. And basically the job is basically grabbing a prostitute, beating her up, sexually assaulting her, and then dismembering her. And the entire film is just that. It runs about 110 minutes and features a 25-minute sequence shot almost in the dark of them driving the prostitute along in a van. You know, Roger Ebert, wrote at the time, it was the worst film ever in competition at Cannes. You know, even one of the jurors who gave it a prize, because it did get the Best Director prize, amazingly enough, said he never wanted to see it again. And the festival is divided between people who more or less saw it and hated it, and those who heard about it from the first screening and thought, I don't want to spend 110 minutes watching some prostitute being abused and then chopped to pieces. So I was one of those people. And, you know, I feel no regret at missing it. You know, there's an intellectual argument that I heard from some very smart friends to defend the film, and I just didn't believe it. I thought there was nothing that film could show me that I didn't already grasp. Are you trying to prove the point that it's wrong to grab people and chop them pieces? I already know most of the things the film would have, so why would I subject myself to that? It was no fun at all. It's just brutal nastiness. And it won one of the top prizes. You know, go figure.
Well, since it won one of the top prizes, did you regret it at all that you didn't see it? Did you feel any responsibility to see it so that you could inform your readers from a position of having witnessed the film as opposed to from the position of having refused to go?
I do and I don't. I mean, I probably now will have to go because it won this award. I saw things at this festival, Terry, you know, that you wouldn't otherwise see. There is in one of the films, a long, long film, there is a scene that is shot from the inside of a woman's womb, and you watch the penis come toward you during a lovemaking sequence. You know, I'm prepared to go with that. I watched people bite one another's throats. I watched people shoot people's heads off. I watched people being scalped. I mean, it's not as if I'm squeamish.
My God, this sounds like such an endurance test.
Yes, you know, this year was, I think, in some ways, the nastiest festival ever.
What is going
and
on?
I think it's probably just happenstance, I guess, is the first thing, that they're all there this year. I think the second thing is that the world film audience is slightly more jaded than it used to be and is after a bit more sensation. You know, in the U.S., you know, many of the most popular foreign films now don't come from Europe but are very violent films out of Japan and Asia. And some of that's carried over, I think, also to Europe. I think also violence has become a way of getting attention at a time when international art movies don't get the attention they used to. I think the other part of it that makes it striking is that this year, because Isabelle Huppert was heading the jury and she has a taste for extreme things, is that all the films that got honored were films that were in one way or another very intense, very violent, either psychologically or physically, often highly sexual. You know, this expresses her taste. And because her taste then defines what wins, that then carries over to everybody's sense of the entire festival.
I know there are some films that you really liked at the Cannes Film Festival that didn't win any prizes. Tell us about one of those, one of the films that you expect we'll get to see in the United States.
Yes. Well, one of the most acclaimed films of the festival, the film I liked, is a Jane Campion film called Bright Star, which is about the romantic relationship between the poet John Keats and a young woman named Fanny Braun, who is an early designer of clothes. And it's basically about their love affair, very, very muted love affair, during the last 2.5 years of Keats's life. It's a very beautiful, elegant movie, maybe a little staid, but it normally would win would have won something at Cannes, I think. But this was a year of extremity, and so all of its virtues—beauty, elegance, restraint, countered against it in a film festival where films were cutting people's heads off and winning awards. Another film very much like it was this Palestinian film that I loved called The Time That Remains by a guy by the name of Ilya Suleiman. And what it is it shows four or five different periods of Palestinian history from 1948 to the present day. But it doesn't do all the stuff that one fears that a Palestinian film would do, which is essentially talk about grievance and be angry. Instead, the Suleiman film shows the transformation of Palestinian life in his hometown of Nazareth through a series of comic and sentimental vignettes. And as you watch, you get a sense of, oh, this is what the actual life of Palestinian people is like, where politics is the backdrop to things that are going on, rather than everybody being some sort of mad bomber or angry person. Suleiman himself lives in Paris, and you can tell that he's agonized at being cut off from his past life, because somehow, if you're in Palestine, you have to care too much about all the politics. Yet he's a tender, funny, gentle filmmaker who's more concerned with, you know, how his father changed over the year. He's watching his mother get older, the way his friends hang out in a cafe and make jokes with one another. That's what he's interested in. And so you get that world, and then in the background, you just see how Palestinian life has gotten harder and harder over the last 60 years. It's a film that makes all the points you would want to make about what it's like to be a Palestinian Israeli, and yet at the same time, it does it so delicately, you don't feel you're being hectored. It's a really good film.
John Powers will be back tomorrow to tell us about more films from the Cannes Film Festival, including Quentin Tarantino's new World War II movie. John is Fresh Air's critic at large and film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Sedum chanson, qui nous ressemble.
Well, the next Fresh Air, the godfather of punk, Iggy Pop, like you've never heard him. His new album, Preliminaire, features standards like Autumn Leaves and How Insensitive, as well as an original song inspired by Louis Armstrong. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Les deux ensemble.